Olá, muito boa tarde. Bonsoir, Mathieu Ricard. I want to thank you in the name of Kangyur Rinpoche Foundation because you are here. Thank you very much. A Fundação Kangyur Rinpoche pediu-me para dizer umas palavras sobre Mathieu Ricard, dispensa qualquer tipo de apresentações, e ele, assim que soube que eu ia fazer isto, disse: mas uma coisa curta. Portanto, é o que eu vou tentar, e socorri-me aqui de uma, felizmente há tecnologia, de umas breves palavras do seu pai. O seu pai, como sabem, era um grande filósofo francês, o Jean-François, e escreveu estas breves palavras sobre o filho. O meu filho, Mathieu Ricard, nasceu em 1946, após os estudos secundários no liceu, fez brilhantes estudos científicos em biologia molecular, que culminaram no seu doutoramento em 1972. O presidente do júri que avaliou a sua tese era François Jacob, o célebre Prémio Nobel da Biologia, e sob cuja orientação Mathieu investigou e trabalhou durante vários anos no Instituto Pasteur. Posteriormente, comunicar-nos-ia, ao seu professor e a mim, o pai, a intenção de abandonar a investigação científica e instalar-se na Ásia para seguir os ensinamentos de mestres budistas tibetanos. Uma novidade que nos deixou a ambos perplexos. Foi uma mudança radical na sua existência, e ele próprio acabaria por se tornar monge budista. De facto, Mathieu Ricard, no seu percurso budista, deixou para trás a sua vida ocidental, tal qual como um romance inspirador, e teve como mestres nomes incontornáveis e muito importantes na história do budismo tibetano, sem salientar Kangyur Rinpoche e Dilgo Khyentse Rinpoche. Tornou-se tradutor de sua santidade de Dalai Lama e foi autor de inúmeros best-sellers, muitos deles à venda ali fora, e também um reconhecido fotógrafo que lembro-me perfeitamente que na sua santidade, a primeira visita, foi aí que eu o conheci, que com as suas fotografias nos honrou e tivemos várias exposições por toda a cidade de Lisboa. Ao vir para aqui, para fazer esta breve, I'm not going to take much longer, quando eu vinha para aqui, não pude deixar de pensar, e gostava que todos pensássemos, o enorme privilégio que é nós estarmos aqui nesta sala. Lá fora o mundo está, não é preciso dizer, onde nomes como pandemia, guerras, alterações climáticas, entre outros, vêm à baila, e nós hoje temos o privilégio de ter um bocadinho para estarmos sentados nesta sala a ouvir uma pessoa como Mathieu Ricard. Essa possibilidade é, em primeiro lugar, derivada de muitas pessoas que trabalharam para que isto fosse possível. E a Fundação Kangyur Rinpoche pediu-me para agradecer os inúmeros esforços à União Budista Portuguesa, à Songtsen, à Associação para a Paz no Mundo, Stupa, ao Mother Earth e ao CASA, o Centro de Apoio ao Sem-Abrigo, que vai beneficiar hoje, vai ser apoiada com a bilheteira dos ingressos deste evento. Era tão bom que o que nós vamos hoje ouvir aqui fizesse com que o mundo ficasse um bocadinho melhor, e para isso se calhar podíamos começar, porque é uma tradição budista, por formular esse desejo de que tudo o que se poderá passar aqui, todas estas palavras que vamos ouvir, sejam em benefício de todos os seres. Eu até arrisco no meu sotaque, que é péssimo, mas dizer uma oração em tibetano que normalmente se costuma dizer nestas ocasiões. Vamos lá ver. Jisinam kane patank, droa jisine geopa, tisidani negorne droedune neuasho. Enquanto existir espaço, enquanto existirem os seres, possa eu permanecer para dissipar todo o sofrimento do mundo. Thank you, Mathieu Ricard. O Mathieu não gosta nada que se fale de um episódio da sua vida que tem a ver com a felicidade e ser o homem mais feliz do mundo, mas de uma palavra, de uma frase muito conhecida de Buda Shakyamuni, em que diz que não existe um caminho para a felicidade é o caminho. Eu acho que peço desculpa por uma ordem natural das coisas, e uma vez que Mathieu trabalha muito em perceber o que é a felicidade e como todos os seres lá chegarem, eu fazendo uma regra simples matemática, que até eu percebo, acho que sim, por ele estar nesse caminho, ele é com certeza um dos homens mais felizes do mundo. Muito obrigado e thank you Mathieu Ricard.
So thank you so much. It's a very wonderful to be back in Portugal. I came always in very happy circumstances, accompanying His Holiness the Dalai Lama. I was also here when Mingyur Rinpoche was there and my other teachers were there. So I'm so glad also to be serving as a little bit of sort of inspiring people to support this wonderful effort that my friends, brothers and sisters here are doing in Portugal for, you know, through CASA, for the homeless and for people in need. It's such a wonderful thing to be in service of others. I think our life should be how do we can become a better human being to better serve others. And then at the time we die, we don't have much regret. We did what we could. And also, the Kangyur Rinpoche Foundation bears the name of my root teacher, Kangyur Rinpoche, whom I met in 1967. So that's, when I think of that, it's a life has been elapsed since then, so many years, more than half a century. This photo was among the photographs that you have seen while you were seated here. And I must say that every good that is in my own life was thanks to the inspiration of my teachers, Kangyur Rinpoche and Gyokensei Rinpoche, Sonis the Dalai Lama, and many others. They are the one, as one of my teachers who often comes to Portugal, Jimmy Kensei Rinpoche said, if I have not met them, probably I would be one of those arrogant scientists. As there are many of them. I'm not sure all scientists are arrogant. I don't think so, but anyway. So I will certainly not have the immense opportunity to spend this life in the Himalaya, and this thanks to their kindness, and that I have a very fortunate and fruitful life, and that I'm here with you today. So last year, at the time of the pandemics and all that, you know, the Mind and Life Institute, to whom I belong now for 20 years, that is something that is very dear to His Holiness, the Dalai Lama, which is to bring together scientists, philosophers, experts in all fields of life, together with himself and also other Buddhist scholars and contemplative, to discuss some of the major issues of our times and of our life. So we had meeting on, you know, destructive emotions, neuroplasticity, the environment, and so forth. And last year, the Mind and Life Europe, which is a branch of Mind and Life here, requested His Holiness to have a dialogue, a virtual dialogue, on our common humanity in time of uncertainty. So His Holiness the Dalai Lama is emphasizing more and more in his message the notion of global responsibility and common humanity. He says now is no more the time of, you know, kings and dictators, although we have a few, unfortunately. I mean, nothing against kings, but people who try to rule by force and by sheer power and discarding the well-being of people in the world. But basically, he said, now it is the time where 7 billion human beings must decide on their future, and they can only do so if there's an element of solidarity, of cooperation, of feeling of belonging, feeling of affiliation between all human beings by recognizing our common humanity, and that's what will allow us to face the challenges of our times. And I would say that very often the Dalai Lama extends that notion of common humanity to common sentience. It's a word that may mean every being who has a mind or a consciousness. And the consciousness, of course, can be something very sophisticated, but it's not just human intelligence. If we look at the Sanskrit and Tibetan words for being, it's something that can go towards something that will favor his survival or his well-being, his physical and mental integrity, and that will try to avoid something that is threatening his physical or mental integrity. So basically, we speak of common humanity, but what is most common to every sentient being, we could say the most common denominator, is the aspiration to avoid suffering. I mean, we may discuss endlessly what is happiness, does true happiness exist or not. Of course, we would all like to have some kind of sense of flourishing, having a good life, a life that we look back and say, well, that was worth living this life. But every moment has been worth living. And if I look at the scope of 20, 30 years, we could say that was good to be in this world for oneself and for others. But, you know, we may have all kinds of definition of happiness. When I was puzzled by the reactions to the Dalai Lama's book, The Heart of Happiness, which is a wonderful book, but some, you know, not everybody likes it. People say, oh, happiness. A French critic said, the dirty works of happiness. We are suffering. On top of that, you say, we must be happy. Leave us alone. You know, don't impose on us the duty of being happy, otherwise we are failing our lives. So there's many definitions of happiness. When I researched for the little book I did on happiness, I even found that happiness is having a good plate of spaghetti. Why not? But I'm not sure that is the ultimate happiness that the Buddha mentioned as the supreme, unchanging, great felicity or great bliss. So there's all kinds of things. But one thing for sure is nobody wakes up in the morning thinking, may I suffer the whole day as much as possible, and that would be great if I could suffer like that every single day of my life. So whether we are a goat or a university professor, no one likes to have a knife stab in one's stomach. So that's really the common ground of all sentient beings, to try to avoid suffering. And also instinctively to try to live life to its full extent. You see our animals who are trapped, just they feel they might be put to death or they don't know, this incredible instinct to somehow try to survive. So we may be completely confused about how to avoid suffering. And in fact, if we look at the Buddhist teaching, like the great master Shantideva in the Way of the Bodhisattva said, we all aspire to happiness, but it seems we turn our back to happiness. We all would like to avoid suffering, but we are running, he says, to the sharp blade of the law of cause and effect that causes our own suffering. In a way, it would seem that sometimes we are addicted to the cause of suffering by cultivating animosity, pride, jealousy, obsession, lack of discernment, confusion. Somehow we keep on perpetuating the cause of suffering, even though our aspiration would be to be free from suffering. So we might be confused, others might be confused, but if you go deep within, no one willingly would like to suffer. So that's the common denominator. We could say that's one of the uncontroversial definition of our common sentience and common humanity. So, you see, once in a meeting with His Holiness, someone spoke about self-hate. So the Dalai Lama turned to his interpreter and he says, "What is he talking about? Self-hate? You hate yourself?" And he said, "Yes." He said, "It's impossible." So the psychologist said, "Well, I'm sorry, there are quite a few people that happens." He said, "No, you cannot hate yourself." So what he meant is that fundamentally, the deepest part of yourself, you cannot fundamentally wish to be unhappy. But the psychologist explained him that it's quite common. Like he said that in Europe, for instance, something like 15, I forgot the number, but it's quite a high number, something like 15 to 20% of youngsters between 15 to 25 have sometimes to self-harm. It's amazing. So it does exist, and it's some often come with traumatism in childhood, having been contempted by others, by one's parents, by one's pair, having the feeling that happiness is not for us, has been constantly denied happiness, having a very low esteem of oneself, the feeling that happiness is not for me. So that's very, unfortunately, quite common. So the psychologist explained that to His Holiness, and he said, "Okay, yes, I understand better. It is also something to do, possibly, with a sense of, you know, wanting to achieve something very special, and we fail to do that, and we reproach ourselves anyway." So the idea that we should start having good benevolence to oneself is something fundamental. And those who work with on self-compassion for people who have self-hate, they say the first step is not to tell people who are harming themselves that it's bad, you know, should not do that, just be happy. Say, "Okay, it's okay to do that if you feel good, if you feel a sense of relief, but maybe you could achieve that sense of relief differently." So make them realize that if at all that happiness in which they don't believe, which has been denied to them, if it was at all possible, they will go for it. And that's the first step. So if we recognize that, then we can move, okay, if you do that, then what is to be done? And what is to be avoided if you want to progress on that path? So now you have identified that in yourself. Then you become more benevolent. So that's the basis of self-compassion therapy and so forth. But that's also the basis for compassion for others. Because once you have identified that, even you feel terrible and you don't have a good image of yourself, you say, "Okay, I'm confused, but if it was possible, I would rather progress towards freedom from suffering. And I should do what brings me more happiness and less suffering." So then you can transport yourself in the mind of others. Okay, they're also very confused. It seems they're acting in ways that bring them endless unhappiness. But they also probably would prefer not to suffer. Then you become also concerned with others. And if you are concerned with others, then you will ethically behave in ways that will not harm others. You'll try, if possible, to bring them some well-being. Then compassion for others come. But that's come from that recognition of our common humanity, our common aspiration not to suffer, our common aspiration to somehow flourish in life. And that to recognize that interdependence, that common denominator, is the fund, the basis for altruistic love and compassion. So that's the sense of common humanity. And that also gives us a sense of universal responsibility. If I can do something for improving the life quality of others, of removing suffering wherever it is, in whichever form it manifests, that will be what we will call a better world. Now, of course, it's easier to speak about that than to do it. But you see, when people say, oh, this idea of unconditional love, unconditional compassion, that's just an idealistic and is so vague. You say, may all beings be happy, then you quarrel with your neighbor or with somebody else very easily. So it's not that when you wake up in the morning, you will think, oh, no, I'm going to change the world. That probably won't last very long. But it is at least, and I heard a social worker in Brazil who dedicated their whole life to people in suffering from very poor and destitute sort of communities. And he said, for me, altruism and compassion is to never exclude anyone from my heart. So that's, it's not about changing the whole world in a few days. You don't exclude anyone. Anyone that comes in the field of your attention, if you can, if you have the capacity, what the resources, the possibility, you will try to relieve their suffering, you will try to bring some good, and you will never say, yes, those people, but not the other ones. So that is such an important attitude, all embracing. And that unconditional compassion doesn't mean that we have to change everyone in the world in a few days. It means that this wish, may being find happiness and the cause of happiness, may beings be free from suffering and the cause of suffering, may that not exclude any sentient being at all. So that's kind of idea of common humanity, common sentience that includes 8 million other species who are our co-citizen in this world. So uncertainty. Uncertainty somehow threatens our wish for happiness. We don't feel at ease, comfortable with uncertainty. So, but even, of course, since the Second World War, at least in Europe, Western Europe, we mostly lived at peace. We have not seen another major war. So many things have progressed. Medicine, we are no use. This idea that human beings manage to extract themselves from nature, they have dominated nature. People who speak about transhumanism say, now, soon we will live 200 years, 1,000 years. I love to be on the balcony of my hermitage looking at the Himalayas. I'm not sure 1,000 years, maybe it's a bit too much. Anyway, if we do have a good life, an altruistic life, of course, living long is a great thing. If we keep on being a nuisance to everyone, I'm not sure living 300 years is such a great thing. But in any case, there was a kind of arrogance that we are the master of nature and so forth. And then fundamental in the fabric of reality because of impermanence, and nothing at all ever is either identical to itself two consecutive moments. That's the fact. Impermanence is the basic texture of the phenomenal world. So that sort of pride that we have dominated nature was shattered down by a little thing that is 1/10 of 1,000 of a millimeter. We know what I'm speaking about, the famous COVID. So, but because we have been sort of spoiled, but everything seems to be going well, we manage to control everything, and suddenly it's just a reminder that this is basically not the case. And then, of course, the tragic war that is now threatening the world and affecting immense suffering, as we see in Western Europe and in Ukraine. It's just unbelievable that such a cruelty could manifest itself. So that's increased uncertainty. But if we think carefully, you know, this is the nature of our life to have uncertainty. Just, you know, the duration of our life. Nobody has ever escaped that. That's we know. That's certain. But the time is so uncertain. No, I may die tonight. Who knows? I don't know. I hope. May not be the case, but I have no certainty at all. So now we may say, well, we'll freak out. No, I may die any moment, so what should I do? Well, basically, it makes us realize that life is so precious, that every moment is so precious. You know, usually I have holes in my soul. But if I knew that I was going to die tomorrow, for sure I'm not going to mend my socks. I'm going to do what is most meaningful, do some practice, think of my teacher, see my beloved friends and so forth, be in nature, try to unite my mind with my teacher's mind, remain in awareness, whatever. So in Buddhism, thinking of that death is certain, but the time of death is unpredictable, is not a morbid attitude. Ooh, I'm going to die, it's terrible, so I do nothing, I just hide like an ostrich. It's to say, wow, now at least I'm possibly a few hours, a few days, a few months, a few years to life. How extraordinary. It's like a river of melted gold. It's so precious every moment. And so see the preciousness of time and use it, extract the quintessence of human life and time. So that uncertainty and impermanence, which is in the fabric of reality, is said to be the spur to engage in wholesome activities. And if we are a Buddhist practitioner, it says it's the spur to make our diligence constant, not being obsessed like frantic diligence, but just use every moment in the best possible way. That doesn't mean, again, running like mad. It could be simply remaining in perfect simplicity in the present moment without hope and fear, just in a transparent awareness. There's not much to do there, but it's such a quality of moment after moment. So to give value of every instant that passes by. So that's in a way how to live meaningfully amidst uncertainty. Another aspect of uncertainty is we have this kind of idea that, you know, if the world could be a certain way, I will be happy. But the problem is that the universe is not a mail order catalog for our desire and fancies. And even there was such a catalog, there are 7 billion human beings using it in different ways. So we cannot have 7 billion parallel universe that will be your universe, the perfect universe that you wish to be. So that is bound to fail. And our control on the outer world is very limited. It's transitory, ephemeral, and often illusory. We are at the top, we are the boss, and suddenly everything collapses, failure, and so forth. Or we are in good health, and then suddenly bitten by a snake. Anything can happen. So that idea, of course, we should do everything we can to bring about a better world. Remedy to poverty in the midst of plenty, social inequalities. Everything we could, you know, child mortality, woman mortality while giving birth, all aspects we should try to improve the outer condition. At the same time, We should not underestimate the power of mind to basically make a hell in the middle of a paradise and just the opposite. We know many people who keep their joie de vivre, their joy of being alive, even in the midst of adversity, and others who, even in the midst of what seems to be a little paradise, are completely destroyed within. In Portugal, when Sanzi Dalai Lama came in one of his visits, I remember in the day he saw many construction works in Lisbon. So in his conference, public talk, he said, there are many buildings, but you know, if you become the owner of a high-tech, super-modern, luxurious flat at the 30th floor of a skyscraper, and you're moving the first time, but you are totally depressed and destroyed within, all you are going to look for is a window from which to jump. So it was a, you know, very stark contrast, showing that even though we need to improve outer conditions, our mind can override the outer condition. Doesn't mean that we should neglect them, but we should remember that in the end, from morning till evening, it is the mind that experiences the world. It is the mind that translates outer condition, either in inner happiness or in inner misery. So if we do change the way we perceive the world, at the same time, our world, the world we perceive, that means our world, will change. And that's much easier than changing everything according to our fancies and our desires. So we should not underestimate the power of transformation of the mind and the need to transform the mind. And in a way, fundamentally, that is the best way to address uncertainty. Because if deep within, you can acquire the confidence of inner freedom, of inner resilience, of inner strength, of knowing that no matter what happened, your mind can come back to this state of freedom, of, you know, resting in the nature of the mind, the transparency, the luminous mind. And the ups and downs of minds are more like the waves at the surface of the ocean. Sometimes the ocean is flat like a mirror. Sometimes there's a big storm, but the depth of the ocean doesn't change. So it will change on the surface, but deep within there's something that doesn't change, something that can be cultivated through spiritual practice, to becoming a good person, an altruistic person, and so forth. And that's a fundamental way to find confidence within the ever-changing world. Now, to be more factual, you know, we have been facing a lot of uncertainties. But somehow, not everyone has reacted differently. And in that discussion we had with the Dalai Lama on our common humanity at time of uncertainty, I was sort of moderating that discussion. And there was a researcher who is affiliated to Mind and Life. He's from Denmark, Andreas Ropstorff. I'm not always pronouncing his name correctly. So he explained to His Holiness a study he did during the first confinement in 2020, the most severe confinement when the COVID came in Europe and elsewhere. He interviewed people from 60 countries, over 1,600 people, in depth. And so, of course, we know that, you know, the rate of domestic violence has increased. We know that there have been more suicide. Teenagers especially, I feel very depressed because their social life was disrupted. Sometimes they had to stay in a small place instead of going to university and learning and meeting their friends. So there have been doubtlessly a lot of suffering, people dying, people feeling sick, not able to see their dying parents, and so forth. So he's just basically asked those 1,600 people from 60 countries. And there were, indeed, about 17% who had a very difficult, painful, traumatic sometimes experience of all kinds. But surprisingly, or not, 50% said they had a very quite positive experience due to that. And it came with many reasons. People say, well, no, we always keep off slowing down. So obviously we slow down. And we keep off not having quality time with our, you know, spouse and family and children. So we had. And we speak of being excessively tired of having to commute several hours a day to go to work and so forth, and that is gone. We speak often of being disconnected from nature and so forth. Now, if we have the opportunity to be sort of confined in a natural place, there's a sense of reconnection with nature. So all those made that half of the people felt that it was a positive experience. So that doesn't in any way cancels the suffering of those who suffer tremendously. But it's also something that happens, so we should also acknowledge that. I mentioned that to a French journalist. He said that we can't speak about that in the press because it looks like we don't pay attention to those who commit suicide or domestic violence. Yes, it exists, but somehow this other half of the people who have a positive experience, this is also a fact. And another aspect was quite interesting in his research. He analyzed, you know, when he questioned people quite extensively, not just yes and no, but he interviewed those 1,600 people, he and his team. And then they made an analysis of the language, the semantic. And they found that during this time of confinement, compared to any kind of similar interviews on any other subject in other times, there was a significant increase of the use of we, us, our, word indicating more a sense of belonging than I, mine, etc. So surprisingly, if you think it's surprising, the fact that people, you know, had these restrictions, could not see that much each other to protect themselves and protect others, there was an increased sense of belonging. Of course, there's always exception, but throughout the 1,600 people, what come out is that they were more feeling the sense of we than I. So that was sort of interesting. At the same time, I had heard on the British radio that there was a website put on from the government for people who could volunteer to bring food to elderly at night, to take them to hospital or whatever. Within 2 days, a million people volunteered. So that also showed a sense of solidarity. So nothing to do with the COVID, but, you know, when there are big natural catastrophes like the Storm Katrina and so forth. In the TV, they say, oh, people were looting and this and that, and the governor sent the army. But in fact, when people actually really studied what the behavior of people in New Orleans at that time, it was just the opposite. They said there was incredible sense of community. They helped each other. There was all these groups going from house to see if elderly were in need, if people. There was an incredible mobilization of goodwill. It's also known that in natural catastrophe, earthquake and so forth, the neighborhood, the people, immediately active much before the firemen, the police, the government send help. So in those times, there's a special institute in the United States that study the behavior of people in natural catastrophe and so forth. Also in like terrorist acts when there's something in the subway in London. What comes out is the sense of coming together, of facing that together, of helping each other. It reinforces it. Of course, there's always people looting and trying to break into some shops and get TV, but also sometimes it's to get water for their kids, so what's wrong with that? So that's also make us think about, you know, a common humanity, about recognizing something about human goodness. It's very easy and, you know, sort of natural to feel discouraged when we see, you know, the increase of polarization in, you know, nations and political life, to see tragedy like in Ukraine, which is just sort of mad few person inflicting infinite suffering on innocent people, and to lose confidence in human nature. The fact is also that, you know, you have a mass shooting somewhere in a school in the US, and immediately that tragedy is sort of reverberates throughout the world in the news. Yes, it is an incredible, unbelievable tragedy. And it is also natural that we pay attention, because this is an aberration, a deviance, and we need to remedy to that. And somehow evolution has equipped us to react to something that is unusual, that is potentially threatening, that is a deviance. We don't react to something that is the norm. You see, today, hopefully, I think nobody is going to have a fist fight in this room. It's normal. You are not going to be, when you come out, you say, oh, that's fantastic. No, nobody had a fight. How come? So nice. People become civilized. No, it's normal. But if two people start fighting, say, there was this Buddhist monk speaking of altruism and so forth, ha, 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 and those people start fighting. So we are going to speak that for a long time. So that means this is not the norm. This is not our default mode. So, you know, Anna Arendt spoke of the banality of evil about Adolf Eichmann. He looks very ordinary, sort of bureaucrat, and he was instrumental in the death of hundreds of thousands of people in the Holocaust. But we could equally speak of the banality of goodness. It's not just, you know, rosy picture of humanity. It is the simple fact that most of the time, most of 7 billion human beings behave decently with each other. That's what we are doing now. I don't know, 500 or 600 people here. And that's somehow banal because we don't pay attention to it, because that's what's happened, and that's because there's nothing special, and that's because what we expect, and we are not surprised, and it's not threatening and dangerous. So it's not to blame the media, but, you know, we have tendency to highlight in our own imagination and also in reporting what goes wrong, the violence, the massacres, the barbarics. I remember once being asked, I forgot for what, in a French TV, and I was interviewed, and they said, okay, we are going to ask you to comment the 5 first items of the news. Here they gave me a list. I look at that, I said, don't you have a good news? There's plenty in the world. You know, I was meeting with one of the journalists before here. I told them a story of a man I met in India, Gurmit Singh, a Sikh. Such a sweet man. Unsung hero of compassion. Very simple. He had a cloth shop in Patna, and all his family were selling cloth, not just to make dress and so forth. But one day this guy, 20 years ago, went to see someone in a hospital, and he came in a room where there was all the sort of, they have a name for that, I forgot in Hindi, sort of the leftover people. That means the people coming from far countryside alone, the homeless, I mean the most destitute people of society, They were all parked in a big room, and a nurse would come from time to time, and sometimes they would give them very poor food, and they were sitting there, scared, alone, nobody looking after them. He was so shocked that he resolved that he will do something. So every evening, when he closed his shop at 7:30 or something, he had a scooter and a big this trailer, and he would go to one of those Indian restaurants where they give packed lunch, and he would bring 30, 40 packed lunch and go to the hospital and give them to those people. Sometimes they were 2 weeks, he would feed them himself. So from every day for 20 years, almost every day, from 8 to midnight, he would do that. And his brother joined, and the family got their resources together. And it's so simple, so loving, so happy to do that. So to be with someone like that is so encouraging about human nature. And then the hospital got upset because they say, oh no, that means a bad image for us. So they tried to prevent it. So he managed to do it. And one time, the Sikh community from London wanted to give him an award. He said, but if I go to London, who is going to take care of those people? So you see, this is the banality. So we should not lose hope. And we should also think that, if we see what brings us, to see him to do that brings us a joy. And also you should see the joy in his face that he has been doing good, just like that, for the sake of doing good. And that's probably the best thing he will remember at the time of death. So it is possible, and we can cultivate it. And also, if we look at a more global level, despair will not do anything. If we think that human nature is bad, the world is bad, and then it's like everyone for themselves. But that's not the way to face the challenges. There are so many challenges and so many uncertainties. Just to take the example of these pandemics and so forth. But in fact, if you go behind that, last 20 years, all the big viral epidemics, starting from AIDS, which of course came from some apes in Africa transmitted to humans, Ebola, and then the SARS, then the avian flu, the porcine flu or the pigs flu, then the COVID, came from two things. Either meddling with wild species because we encroach in their territories, and that's the case for AIDS, for Ebola, and avian flu. Or this crazy environment of industrial farming where you get hundred thousands of chicken in a big hole like this, with about 10 people looking after them, and it's like, everything can happen in terms of germs and virus propagating. So all of this came from unhealthy relation with other species. And there's just an article came out in the scientific magazine Nature saying that now with the climate change and the destruction of primitive forests and so forth, the exposure of humans to wild species keep going on vast increase. And with that, the probability of becoming in contact with viruses and germs that we have not been in contact so far is vastly increased. So that shows, this is more this notion of interdependence and global responsibility. So that's how we can deal with that. So obviously, not with selfishness. Selfishness will not do the job at any level, neither the short term, nor the mid term, nor the long term. Take poverty in the midst of plenty. A mother in Africa whose main priority is to feed her children within the next few days. That needs to be addressed. And if we don't care, then famine starts to prevail. So the organization tried to prevent famine and so forth. Now the midterm, if we don't care about people, then the conditions at work, social inequality, they will remain. And as you know, social inequalities have been increasing in all the rich countries of the OECD the last 30 years. And even during the COVID crisis, inequality increased further because it's always the most destitute who suffer most in all those situations. And finally, selfishness will not be the answer for the biggest challenge of our time, which is the 21st century, which is the environment crisis. Because we today, 7 billion human beings, are defining the situation in which future generation will live. That's the first time in history of humankind. You know, remember that even only 10 to 12,000 years ago, there was only five, of course, there was no census, but we say about 1 to 5 million people on Earth, human beings. Even that, before that, about 50,000 years ago, there was all kinds of fast climate change that came with that our species was reduced, according to genetic analysis, to 40,000 individuals. We almost didn't make it through. So we are all cousins because we came all from 40,000 people that survived. So then, 10,000 years ago, the climate became much more stable. We call that the Holocene. Especially stable time until now. We start messing it up about 100 years ago. And that allowed the hunter-gatherers to settle, to raise cattle, to make agriculture, to amass wealth. Then people became more wealthy than others, so they start conflict also. And the vast increase of the population, domestication of animals and so forth. So that led from few millions to 7 billion within no time. But at the same time, you know, our power got increased exponentially. Now, before we had tools that we could throw at the best, that much harm or good we could do. Now we have tools that are immensely more powerful, you know, atomic energy, fossil fuel, electricity, all that. But the level of care for others hasn't increased at the same magnitude as our power to act. So that unbalance is what causes the environmental crisis. Because next generation, they will say, you knew and you did nothing. So now we are shaping the future of those future generations. We decide of their future. And some philosophers say they have no rights because they don't exist. So they cannot claim their rights. They cannot reciprocate. So that's what the definition of right is. You should know you have a right and you should reciprocate. But that's crazy because they will exist for sure and they will not want to suffer. So the natural right they have is that they don't suffer from our negligence. So we are facing that, those three time scale, the immediate needs, the need to flourish in life, and the need of future generation. So think of one concept, as selfishness will not do the job. That will be the thread that would allow to sit around one table, politician, environmental scientists, investors, common citizen, social activists, a mother in Africa, everyone, and just think how we could build a better world. And there's only one concept that can bring them together and not have a schizophrenic dialogue. It is having more consideration for others, care, caring for others. If you care for the mother in Africa, you will provide for her need. You will put her children at school. You will look after her health. You will avoid that a 13-year-old girl is married against her will. All this, if you have caring, you will do something to prevent that. If you care for people, you have consideration for people, you will remedy. You will get out of your way to remedy to poverty in the midst of plenty, to ensure that people have a decent life, that they can cooperate without being abused by the system, the economical system and so forth, to have an economy that is at the service of society and not society at the service of economy, that people, you know, can fulfill their basic aspiration in life, have a good life, why not? And then, if you have more consideration for others, you will make sure that you don't jeopardize the fate of future generations. You will seriously change our behavior now, thinking of what will happen to future generations. And despite all the COP, up to 26, all those resolutions are not really implemented enough. Environmental scientists now speak of an environmental crisis. A crisis is something that is imminent, and we have a very short time to intervene. So, of course, the scientists say we can do something, there is a solution. And people say, oh, they have a solution, great. But when you say, what is the solution, all those environmental scientists say, well, that implies drastic changes in our lives. That's necessary for our children, your children, your grandchildren. So that's a must. So why should not we have the guts to do it? So that's a mystery. We should do that. So that's the sense of global responsibility. That's the sense of common humanity, which we share with also future generations, that we need to implement. So that's, the hope is not lost, but we need to do it before it's too late. Yet it is true that evolution has emotionally equipped us for some immediate danger. We are quite good at reacting when something is really threatening. I mean, in fact, the measures of confinement done last year in 2020, the first time, were quite drastic. You know, I was in Nepal, but the street I heard was empty here in Paris, everywhere. It's, you know, people were scared, but also they saw that the point of following those drastic measures. So it is possible for government to take such measure and for people to follow. So if there was the same recognition of that urgency for the environmental crisis, and if there was the even half of that determination from government to do something as drastic about it, then we would probably get somewhere. So that's our challenge, that's our duty, that's what we need to do. And we need to realize common humanity was defined in a way by Martin Luther King when he said, well, we came in different vessels, but now we are all in the same boat. There's no environmental change, climate change, no border. Epidemics, no border. They don't need a visa or passport to go from one place to the other. You know, I've been spending half a century in the Himalayas, including in Bhutan, 10 years. There's one glaciologist in Bhutan, only one. And he sees with despair those glaciers melting. There's a lake, a glacial lake, 50 million cubic meters of water, the moraine, that the natural dam that keeps that water, in 10 years went from 50 meters thick to 15 meters thick. Now they are trying to bore holes to evacuate the water. If it was breaking, everyone down in the valleys, there would be like a tsunami, and hundreds or thousands, or maybe thousands of people would die. In the Himalaya alone, there are 3,000 significant lakes that have no names, simply because they didn't exist 30 years ago. So that's the third pole is melting. So all these things, you know, they see that, and those countries like Bhutan, Nepal, you know, they didn't do much, if anything at all, for global warming. You know, a US citizen emit 200 times more CO2 than a Zambian, a Qatari 2,000 more times than an Afghani. So that unbalance is not healthy. Is not reflecting our common humanity and sense of responsibility. And usually, you know, it's actually consuming much too much in wealthy countries. And it's not that we should not help the poor countries to have a minimal development to get access to renewable energy so that the kids can study with solar lights instead of some kind of burning oil that harm their eyes, and so forth. But it's stopping that madness of overconsumption, the rush for luxurious, unnecessary things. You know, when there's two cars for three people in North America, this is just crazy. So, you know, a friend of mine, who is a wonderful economist, said we should do, you know, buy some space in the advertisement and say, don't buy what we don't need, please. You know, in 1930s, the birth of marketing was made. And those people who get the idea of marketing said the marketing is basically about wanting people, making people desire what they don't need and buy it. Because if you really need something, you don't need advertisement. You know, you need a bucket or something, you go and you buy the bucket. Advertising is all about making you buy what you don't need, basically. So all these things makes that we are drawn in the superfluous, and we lack the idea of happy simplicity, and that's the major cause of this, you know, global warming thing. So all this, in a way, the more we take in account our common humanity with every other human beings and also with other species, the more we see the sense of global responsibility. We are all together in this adventure to face tragedy, to solve conflicts, to remedy to climate change, to remedy to social inequalities. So only more altruistic, compassionate, considerate attitude can do that. We can change individually because we know that we can learn to read and write, to play the piano, to play chess. We can also improve our capacity for altruism, for kindness, for dedication to others. It's a skill. Those skills can be cultivated. People who have trained their mind can assert that. Neuroscientists have studied that. So if you train over a few months, your brain will change, you will change. It is possible. And then, if, of course, individual change is not enough, it has to have a critical mass so that the culture changes. We go from a more individualistic culture to a culture of sense of responsibility to each other. So those cultures can change. And there have been studies about the evolution of culture, which is a Darwinian phenomena, but is much faster than genes. Culture can change in one, two, or three generations. Look at attitude toward war. In the 19th century, it was still described as the melting pot of civilization. People were, you know, going to war, singing, and so forth. It was sort of heroic, beautiful. Now we see our barbarian, unbelievably barbarian it is, and the example is just at our door. Nobody will say war is such a heroic, beautiful thing. So culture have changed, even with the environment, although we cannot take enough decision. But compared to 30 years ago, I'm 76, when I was 16, that's a lot of years, when Rachel Carson's book came, Silent Spring. Now, we were a bunch of bird watchers and lovers of nature. You know, nobody was really interested. It was the first book that struck the public imagination. So now, even though we don't know how to handle that hot pot of the ecology, we know it's a major challenge to our future. So culture can change, you know, and it's possible when you get a critical mass. And if culture changes, we change our institution. So first we need to change ourselves, then we change our culture, then we change our institution. Of course, the clock is ticking. We don't have that much time, especially for the environment. They say for 10 years before we do major changes. Will we make it? I don't know. But at least if we are aware of it, and if we think we have deep conviction that we should act together, with goodwill, with sense of fraternity, with sense of cooperation, with sense that common humanity and caring You know, people may say, oh, compassion has no place in the economic system, you know, that's something else, but who say today, I don't care for future generation? No, that we cannot say that. So let's care in our own life. CASA is doing that for those who are in need. We don't have enough food for the homeless. So we should do what we can at our level. The definition of efficient altruism is a concept that you can see, for instance, in Peter Singer's book, The Most Good You Can Do, is that it's nice to do good, but it's even better to do it well. So do it well means with the time, with the resources, with the funds, with the capacity, the energy that you have, where can you do the most good? With a certain amount of money or whatever, where can you improve the health of someone in the best possible way? Or to save the eyes of some strange sickness that affects many children in Africa, it costs $5 to save the eyesight. So, well, if you have $100, what do you do? 20 eyes there or, I don't know, you see? So the efficient altruism is to really think in our life, where can we do the most good with the time, the resources, the, whatever we have at hand. So this is a very, I think, healthy concept, because somehow we can't do everything, but we can do something. And so I hope that, you know, we can try in our life. This potential is within us. According to Buddhism, we say that we have the Buddha nature, which is like a golden nugget within ourselves. It might be covered more or less in some people. It might be fallen in the mud. But if we pick it up, if we polish it, it is there. At least the potential is there. If it was not the case, if human nature was fundamentally bad, it would be like a piece of charcoal. You can polish it for 100 years, it would not become like gold. If gold is there, you can clean it, you can polish it, and then gold itself has never changed, but it was hidden. So in a way, we are like a beggar who has this gold under his or her hut, doesn't know, is poor, yet rich at the same time. So we have this potential within our human life, and we can bring it to the surface, and that will make a fulfilled human life. So, sorry for taking so much time of your precious time, but, you know, the blah, blah monk. My contribution to global warming. So, apologies.
Thank you so much, Mathieu Ricard, for your kindness and your generosity and sharing your wisdom with us. As agreed, you will take one or two questions from the audience. They must be short and on the subject, as we agreed.
Sure.
Mathieu Ricard vai muito simpaticamente responder só a uma ou duas questões da audiência. Pede que sejam curtas e sobre a temática em causa. Se quiserem colocar em inglês ou em francês, são bem-vindos. Se quiserem colocar em português, eu vou tentar dar uma ajuda para traduzir.
So one or two is a bit daunting, no? Let's make three or four.
Okay.
One or two, you know, wow.
I was being too strict. I'm sorry. Portanto, podem perguntar três ou quatro perguntas. Podem colocar três ou quatro perguntas, ok? Alguém vai ter convosco com o microfone. Está ali uma senhora lá ao fundo.
É para ligar.
Vamos lá chegar. Ah, a senhora está-se a movimentar. Acho que vão encontrar aí um meio termo.
I have a question on interconnection for the environment. For the people that don't believe that everything's interconnected. What is a message that you've used that can help us share that message, that we're not separate?
I'm bad hearing, so sorry.
So for people that do not believe that we are interconnected, how to make people still...
Oh, very easy. Yeah, give me this, okay. I don't need... You see this A4 size? No, it's no more white because she writes something on it. A white A4 size paper, okay? I have a friend in Harvard called Greg Norris. He studies the what is involved in all these common things we use. He said about 30 countries for a white sheet of white paper. The potato might come from Czechoslovakia for the starch. The wood might come from Finland or Norway. I forgot which one has a lot of forest. Then the truck may be from Dutch truck. And then they make paper paste somewhere in Italy. Then they carry. Then they maybe a Spanish truck will carry to France, where some guy who is actually from Africa will sell it in a shop. Something like that. An iPhone, he says 70 countries are involved. You know, rare metals and so forth. So, you know, basically, you know, in Brittany, where my family come from, they sell, maybe here also, you can buy some mug with your name, you know. I never found one with Matthew with two T's and so forth. So, but really, if you make the story of that cup, where you should write in small writing, it's others, all over the place. Because, look, the earth came from somewhere, that guy who brought the clay, you know, all his family was responsible for him being able to, his grandfather, his mother gave him life. You know, all these things happened, so many people got involved. And then he bought the clay. And then likewise, so many other people. So in fact, we speak of ecological footprint, but the handprint of gratitude in a way, or gratitude of people got involved, you know, in even us being here together. How many people, the transport, the things, the theater, the mag we build, the whole each one, electrician, he has a family. Thanks to all that, he managed to be here, he got an education. So basically, this interconnection is everywhere and we don't even see, but it's sort of shouting, others, everywhere. If we are suspended in space, finished. So anyway, that's something that we need to think about. And I think, I remember one of the universities in America where they studied that, they were making children think about that. It's so important. You know, they said the sweater you wear, how many number of different people were involved. So that's the way. Now, fundamentally, if you want to go a little bit deeper in the philosophical aspect of it, there's nothing that is in the universe that can be purely autonomous. If there was something autonomous, means not being interfered with anything else. That means that thing basically will not belong to our universe, because everything is happening in connection with something else. We call the interdependent arising. This only happens in relationship. Nothing exists on its own, of its own, and is not a result of cause and effect that are changing, and itself a cause or condition in the big mesh of interdependence to make other events happen. So it's like a big, you know, like a big spider net. You pull on some way, it's also moved the other side. Something that would be autonomous it will not act on anything, and it could not be acted upon anything else. It will be out of this world. So we only in this world because everything is connected and interacting with everything else. So that's the way things are. And also, in terms of our own life, you know, if we think that my own happiness, I can build it in my little corner because that's easier. I don't mind about others being happy, but it's not my job. That suppose that you could build up in that little bubble of you know, ego, selfish, self-centeredness. But it doesn't work because we are not. Our happiness and suffering happens with and through others, not just in isolation. We are not like snooker balls that sometimes interact but just exist solidly on their own. So it's a basic mistake that end up in frustration because we cannot build such a completely selfish happiness. It's bound to fail. And it's very unpleasant also to feel that way. Well, if we recognize, as I mentioned in the beginning, our interconnectedness, then that's also the foundation for altruism and compassion. So it's not, doesn't take rocket science to think that nothing exists in isolation, but all through relationship.
Mais alguma questão? Estou a ver ali senhor com o braço levantado, uma t-shirt branca. Já aí vão ter consigo.
Thank you, first of all, for sharing your wisdom. And I would just like to know if now with what we've heard, like if you could share some practical exercise for how we can uncover our Buddha nature and become more positive in the world.
Wow. Nice subject. Well, shall we take appointment for next year? Well, I'm teasing. Well, it's, you know, Shantideva said there's no big, difficult task that cannot be broken into a series of small, easy tasks. So step by step. Well, you know, thought after thought, emotion after emotion, and that's how, you know, moods, traits can be changed. And also, somehow, you know, you speak of wisdom and recognizing something. It also comes from listening, studying, reflecting, meditating. That means listening to words of wisdom, the ageless wisdom of humanity. So I'm speaking from the Buddhist perspective. So there are many wonderful philosophical treatises on contemplative life, on the nature of reality, nature of mind. Then you should listen to those who explain them properly. Just to give an example of Buddhism, but that's same for science or something else. Then think deeply about it. You know, come to an inner certainty, not because somebody said that it should be true. We say, like examining gold by, the Buddha said, examine my teaching like you examine a piece of gold by rubbing it, beating it, melting it, see if it's pure gold. Then once you get a genuine certainty, you need to digest, to integrate that in your mind, and that's through familiarization, through training, what we call, some people call meditation, just training the mind, familiarization. So all that process gradually, you know, erodes the obscurations that mask the Buddha nature and make gradually that Buddha nature become more and more obvious. So it's not an all or none process, it's a gradual process. So the Buddhist path, because you speak about Buddhism, is not about fabricating something new that will be the Buddha nature or enlightenment. It's about clearing the obscuration that masks what has always been there. So that's, I think, one perspective. So it takes time, but it's worth doing. Okay.
Mais alguma? Está ali senhor em pé, com uma camisa azul.
Thank you very much. I'll make it as simple as I can. Research on complexity shows that civilizations can kind of collapse without understanding the reasons behind it. They also show that faced with complexity, people and communities can become very frustrated and violent, and also faced with complexity, people can give up on common processes or constructive processes. My question is, do you think that the Mind and Life Institute can have a role in helping to simplify the international relations framework as to this fuse, this tension that I do think that believes because things have become so complex?
Okay, you know, complexity is just another name for interdependence. It looks, some modern philosopher seems to be rediscovering interdependence with amazement. I mean, give us a break, you know, it's like 2,500 years it has been central to Eastern philosophies that everything is basically interdependence. So if everything is interdependent, you cannot ascribe a one single linear cause to an event. It's like everything is involved. And this is not just a goofy idea from Buddhism. You know, I think it's Schrodinger or Heisenberg, I forgot, said when there's a particle disintegrates, you say there's no cause because you could not predict the moment. You know it will disintegrate, half time is say 10 years or 50 years, but you can't say when. So it's not that it's pure random. He said it's simply that the whole universe somehow is implicated in that. So you cannot predict it by, you know, measurement and calculation and all that because it's so vast. So complex means just that everything is involved. You know, Ernst Mach, he was the one who discovered the Mach of the sound barrier, but also he was a great physician and precursor who understood the idea of inertia. When you push a car, for instance, you try to move your car, the most difficult is the beginning. When you set in motion, then it's easier to continue to push it, right? So Mach said, there's no simple physical law that I can explain that. He said, because the whole universe is somehow involved. So I don't know how, but he didn't either explain, but it means this complexity is basically recognizing the interdependence. So in a way, that's complexity. You know, the word complexity has been, we can't understand, there's too much things and everything. But at least if we understand that behind complexity, there's interdependence, it makes a lot of clarity. Everything interacts. Everything happens in relation, neither in isolation. Now, what was the other part of the question? Mind and life. Well, it's a very nice institute, but, you know, we try our best like many others. And again, interdependence means that everyone has to try in their own field. Mind and life alone, and nobody alone would ever do anything like that. I mean, that measure. But yes, it's part of the evolution of cultures. You know, when I start studying altruism, it could have been pretty discouraging. But what was highly encouraging is we could see how, you know, I heard one of the leading scientists of environment say, in the end, it's a question of altruism. If we don't care about future generation, there's no environment problem because we won't be there. So no problem for us, isn't it? So likewise, in all fields, you know, like Dennis Snower, leading economist of the G20, said we need the voice of care along the voice of reason in economy. So many fields, people start to see the need for care, the need for compassion, the need to understand interconnection, the need to concern. So that Mind and Life is part of that tapestry that together could help us to build a better world. Now, there are contrary forces. The narcissistic epidemic that has started in North America, but it's also coming everywhere. Hyper-individualism, you know, the demagogues, populists, and all that. The division that we see now, splitting nations on the political divide more than ever somehow. So those are contrary forces. But in a way, you know, this is always this balance. But somehow, you know, we should have the confidence and that the constructive forces can be stronger, because somehow one of the reasons is not just empty hope, is they are more attuned to reality. You know, a view, something that will make you act based on interdependence, based on sense of global responsibility, based on altruism rather than selfishness, functions better because it's more attuned to the way things are. Dividing people, isolating people, acting out of, you know, basically mental darkness and confusion is somehow at odds with reality. So at some point it's going to dysfunction. So that's probably the hope. And another hope, if I may say, is that, you know, natural selection always selects the traits which are good for survival. So if one trait is good for our survival now, it would be cooperation, not selfishness. So let's hope that even we are silly enough not to do anything, evolution will take care of all the selfishness, and maybe they'll reduce slowly. Okay, last question then. Yes. One very determined lady there.
Signore in pé.
I would prefer to ask you afterwards, because it seems so primitive, but I don't know how quickly you're going to disappear. So I ask now.
Okay.
Feeding the hungry versus micro-lending. Why is there so little emphasis on micro-lending, which restores people's sense of proud or self, and when it's done, can completely change the life of a village? I've seen so many faces lit up because of what it does to a group of people. I think you're doing a bit of this micro-lending, right? You know, but I'm not sure. Anyway, I like that.
Okay, well, you know, it's a vast problem, and, you know, there have been, like, all the Nobel Prize of Economy went to Esther Duflo and her husband, something Banerjee, who have studied the mechanisms to eradicate extreme poverty. And clearly, empowering people is the best way. But she also said that giving them the financial means to do so is essential. So microcredit, you know, has a mixed track record. You know, it depends how it's done. You know, the Grameen Bank in Bangladesh, a lot of success. In other countries, a lot of success. Some places didn't work that well in long term. So in any case, we should be always multidimensional. You know, the homeless here or in Paris or somewhere, who is usually often a migrant or someone facing, you know, alcohol or something abuse or whatever causing that person's life, being homeless. Sometime in the dead of the winter, what he needs is food and a blanket, not micro-lending. Probably would end up with a bottle of wine or something in some cases. So everything has to be dealt at different level. You know, the social SAMU in France is overwhelmed. They only can deal with one-tenth of the people they could deal with. So it's a society problem to leave the most deprived in a state of without having, you know, being able to restart a decent life and give them some training and housing and so forth. So it has to be dealt both at the emergency level and the midterm and the long term, and micro-lending as its place into that. Empowering people with vocational training. That's what we do in India. We help with Karuna Sechen. We help 400,000 people every year in India, Nepal, and a little bit in Tibet. So one of the big part of that is empowering women, literacy, vocational training, all kinds of things like that. You know, working with preschoolers. We made 60,000 kitchen garden in India. That means the people who do monoculture, only rice or wheat, then they buy their vegetable and fruit at the marketplace for a farmer. That's ridiculous. So 60,000 gardens means we give them sprouts of 30 different species. They grow that to feed the family. They exchange with their neighbors. So all these things are part of getting out of extreme poverty. Microlending is one example, but there are so many other ways to do so. So I think we should just continue, you know, not only the implementation, but the research on what works best for remedying to extreme poverty. And there are many ways, but we should do our best and continue to do so and not ignore the problem. So thank you so much.
Angelica, thank you very, very much. This is a Portuguese swallow. We believe it brings spring. We hope it will bring peace as well.
But there's a swallow inside?
It's a swallow, yes.
Oh, should I open so that it flies?
Yeah, no, it won't fly.
It won't fly?
No.
Okay, too bad.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
It's a swallow. It's a swallow. It's a porcelain swallow. It's a typical Portuguese. It's okay, I will do.